Welcome to part two of episode four of Stick With It, discussing industrial relations and negotiating EAs. Now, back to the discussion.
Now, the term professional negotiators has long been bandied around when an EA is up for renegotiation. Now, I know that every individual in this room and probably listening has an opinion on this. So today I've got these four gentlemen in the room. So from your perspective, can you please provide your thoughts on this concept?
That's actually a really good question, Huff, because I can say that before I started becoming involved with APA, my view was absolutely we should engage professional negotiators. So, and I think the idea that people have in their head is a professional negotiator is this person who has all of these skills, who can walk into the room and produce results that otherwise you would not have had. And I think before you start thinking about that, you probably need to think about, well, what are the skills that a professional negotiator or a good negotiator might have? And in my view, I think that to be able to negotiate effectively, the person, or probably more importantly, the team, needs to have a bunch of skills. And I think you can probably split that into sort of three areas. First, I think whoever's in the room has to be a subject matter expert. So you have to have the ability to understand the agreements that you're working under, understand the implications of changes to those agreements. I think the person or the team also has to have, you know, what I'd call the skills across the table, being able to be a good communicator, a good listener, being able to think quickly on their feet to changes in the room, being able to read the room, read the reactions of the other parties. And then I think what sits above all of that is when you're starting to work out how you're going to negotiate, what you're going to pursue, you need to be able to analyse the power that the parties have in the room. So power basically comes from options. So you need to be able to analyse the options that you have to take, things like industrial action, agreeing, not agreeing to things, and analysis of the power that the other party has. So particularly, so talking in the case of recent events, the company threatening to take flying for various entities in a group and sending that flying elsewhere. So being able to analyse, can they do it legally? If they can't, but they do it anyway, what are the options? So it's a combination of all of those skills. Now, I'm agnostic as to where we get those skills from. So APA's made up of people who are volunteers, we've got permanent staff, we've got consultants, and we also send out for advice externally. So I'm agnostic as to where those skills come from, but I think it's important that we identify people who have those skills, we recruit them, and that we retain them and we skill them up and keep them in the organisation.
So a question on that. I mean, in the room, how much negotiation happens on the fly? And what I mean by that is that obviously if you guys understand, you need people to understand the contract so that if there's stuff happening actually in the room, you can't say, hang on a sec, we just need a break and go and, you know, ring the person who knows the contract. Having people in the room that know the contract, is there benefit to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes, you can take a break and do those things. I mean, no one should be concerned about doing that actually in the room. But for me, there are three big things in the room that you need to be able to do. You need to know your subject material inside and out. And the reason is because you need to do this mental gymnastics by going, okay, well, if this is the particular proposal, what clause would we change in the agreement? And if we were to do that, what other areas of that particular agreement would it affect? In the mainline sense, you also have to have a very good working knowledge of the other agreements. So if we're negotiating short haul, you need to know a little bit about long haul as well, because they can interact with each other in a way that's highly important.
It feels like pulling a circuit breaker on an aircraft. You don't know what other systems potentially impact.
Well, on an Airbus anyway, yeah.
Okay. but
also the integration award as well. You need to have a very, very good working knowledge of that so you can, you know, discuss these things in a sensible kind of way. The other aspect that I think you absolutely do need at the table is the ability, is your communication ability. You need to be able to speak and actively listen to the other party. Otherwise, it just won't work. You will lose your train of thought. And I can guarantee you that doing those things within the room is exhausting. It takes a lot of mental effort to do that. But probably for every hour that we do across the table, we do about 4 hours of preparation. So if you do your preparation, you can do that. The third part, just on the my final point on the professional negotiators, and one of the other skill sets that you need to be able to do is at all times you need to be aware of where your constituency is at. You need to know the feeling of the pilots out there, and you need to know what their interests are. Have they changed? Are there external factors that do change some of the things that you've done? So it really depends on what we're talking about and how you define what are we hoping to get out of this professional negotiator. I mean, we have legal staff here. We get legal advice. We get strategic advice from external consultants as well and internal staff members. So we already do a lot of things and engage a lot of professional services anyway. If at some point in time there is someone who can contribute at the table and can assist in ticking those boxes for us in the skill set, absolutely, let's get them on board.
Yeah, I'd like to add and echo the words of both Chris and Mark. I mean, and I would just want to add this, is that the reality is that a pilot's agreement is a really a complex thing. It interacts, as Mark said, with various other things, but also with legislation and with regulations. And as somebody that has not been employed under a pilot's agreement ever in my life, I can testify that no one negotiates more passionately and more effectively on these agreements than somebody that has actually lived and breathed the agreement. Me, we've been with APA for 11 years, sitting through various negotiations, dealing with numerous issues, still sometimes find myself not understanding completely the enormity of an issue that's been discussed because I haven't lived and breathed through that. So I was like Chris when I first heard the idea of professional negotiators when I started APA. I thought, well, that sounds like a good idea to get somebody with leather shoes and a suitcase in to come and tell us how to negotiate. But the reality is, and I've seen it firsthand, that, yeah, nothing competes with somebody that has lived and breathed the agreement to actually negotiate passionately about it.
Do they exist, these sorts of people? I mean, are they like unicorns?
No, they do exist. It depends in what area. So some people may have used a buyer's agent when going to buy a house. They're a professional negotiator. They intimately know the market, they know the estate agents, they know their client, they know what their client wants, they can work out what the vendor wants, and they're the whole package in one. That's a professional negotiator. And they have subject matter expertise. They know their constituents. They tick all of the boxes that Chris, Mark and Philip have talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very small area. You expand that out to something as complex as the long-haul agreement, then it's very, very difficult for one person to have that level of knowledge, the experience, and the abilities with communication. So when I think of a professional negotiator, for me, it's a team. I don't think, and I've done a number of enterprise agreements in long and short haul, and I cannot conceive of an individual, anybody. If you could choose anybody on the planet who could do it, it's a team, because you need the knowledge, the abilities at the table that a team will bring.
So skill sets that complement each other.
Absolutely. You want to bring a team together, preferably that they know each other well. You want to build a synergy. That's important. At the table, being able to read each other is as important as trying to read the people across the table. That it's a very intimate thing to do, to bargain like that. It's intense. And so for every hour at the table, we'll spend 4 hours. That's just the prep that we do together. On top of that, we may have done other hours and hours of preparation. I would say probably 80% plus of the preparation work that we do in an EA doesn't actually get used at the table. But you have to do that work. You have to do that preparation in case.
And that's probably the one thing that we left out of how do you approach an EA. First step is coming up with the team. And it's critically important so you get the training right. We all conduct training. Here at APA, we get externals into to train us up on various aspects of negotiation. But the team is critical. So maybe it's not a professional negotiator. It's a team. It's a team effort. And if you can tick all those boxes, whether they're paid staff members, external consultants, or volunteers, you want the best team at the table, which covers all those skill sets to get the best possible outcome for our members.
Okay. And I'm happy to acknowledge that, you know, people out there are going to have differing views. And again, when a survey comes around, you know, feedback, thoughts is always welcome. But I think it's important just to get your side of it. So thank you for that. Now, keeping our members informed through an EA negotiation is obviously a challenge. We are already planning some new ways to try and improve the methods of comms delivery for next year. However, I'm curious about the actual challenge of what you can and can't say as negotiations are ongoing. So can you guys provide us with some context to those challenges?
Oh, I'd be the first to admit that I think communications with our members is one of the most difficult parts of conducting a negotiation, because you've got a balance. On the one hand, as a negotiating team, we are agents for the members. We are negotiating on their behalf, so they have a right to know what it is that we're trying to bargain for and how we're doing it. The other side of the equation is that when we're trying to squeeze what little we can out of the industrial relations system as it stands, and we're trying to use these communication skills across the table, generally we're trying to come up with solutions to problems that have us discussing things, you know, outside of the box type solutions. So we need to be able to sit at the table and discuss things without prejudice. Mm-hmm. So there'll be things that we talk about that, if taken out of context, could really be seen in a way that would be damaging to the negotiation. So it's difficult coming up with that balance between being able to talk without prejudice and the parties having confidence about what they're saying stays confidential at the table when we're trying to kick around solutions, but also appropriately letting our members know what it is we're doing, because we're acting on their behalf. So I think that's something that we do need to improve on, and something that we are actively looking at.
I don't really have anything else to add from that, except to reiterate that it is a very difficult part of it. Lots of factors go into when we communicate and what we actually communicate. We have got it wrong in the past. It's something where potentially for some members we'll be communicating too much, for other members we're not communicating enough. It's a really complex area, and we've got communication staff in here to assist us as well with all of that.
Because basically what you're saying is you could be negotiating at a meeting, there's some, I guess, chips on the table, and if you then that night put an email out saying that those chips are on the table, then next week suddenly those chips come off the table because you're then doing a deal in another area. And suddenly what you've promised then now is no longer current, and Definitely. It's causing confusion.
Absolutely. The negotiation ebbs and flows and things can change. And if you send something out to the members and you say, this is what we're talking about, well, then there's an expectation then that that's the direction that's going to go. And that's 90% of the time that's not the case. Things change. So we kind of need to get over a certain number of hurdles first before we go, okay, we're relatively confident this is the direction a particular issue will go. We'll try and bring the members up to date. But it is vitally important to bring your constituents on along with you, because if you don't bring them along, then all of a sudden you dump an EA on them, which they don't know anything about.
Yeah.
It's just not, as Chris said, we're representative of the members. We need to keep them informed.
So do negotiations tend to sort of solidify late? Like, you know, it's almost like it's almost like a cake that kind of, it stays really mushy until the last minute, and then it kind of really comes together late.
It's interesting, because when you brought that up, I was going to add to what Mark said, and one of the first things we generally make a point in the negotiations is nothing's agreed until the end. So it may well be, because the EA is a package. So it may well be the company might want to sign off on two or three things that it's got on its list of needs, and you tick off on that, but nothing else of ours gets met. And we say, well, they go, you've already agreed to these things. So it's like nothing's agreed until we get to the end. So if you communicate some things that have been agreed at the time across the table, at the end of the negotiation, they may not be agreed. So you're exactly right. It's a negotiation, an EA or a variation, it's a package. So it comes together at the end.
Okay.
Nothing's agreed till it's all agreed.
Yes.
So that is, said that many and times.
It's probably going a little bit off topic, but that is one of the most difficult parts of a negotiation in my mind, is to when to call an agreement as agreed. And it can happen within half an hour, and you cannot see a company. You will have an idea that you're going down a particular path, but it can all coalesce really quickly if everything falls in place.
Okay. Now, it's hard not to notice what's occurring with other unions at the moment in their own respective negotiations. So PIA, or Protected Industrial Action, is starting to occur in some instances. So can you explain to us exactly what PIA is? At what point in an EA negotiation does taking PIA become an option? Does it require a vote of members? What sort of time frame can it occur over, and can it escalate? And does it work? Now, before you answer that, if anyone in Flight Ops is listening to this podcast, before you do your NANA, we are not threatening or advocating PIA. However, it's important that our members have a good understanding of all the elements associated with any EA negotiation, and this is part of that. So I put it to you, can you give us a bit of an explanation about those areas, please?
Sure. I'll start with off just by saying what protected industrial action is. The Act says that in protected industrial action, or industrial action, is any of the following actions: employees performing work in a manner different to how it is normally performed, employees adopting a practice that restricts, limits, or delays the performance of work, a ban, a limitation, or restriction by employees on performing or accepting work, a failure or a refusal by employees to attend for work, and then the lockout of the employees. So that is what is broadly defined as what industrial action is. Protected industrial action is referred to when a party has taken certain steps before taking the action, which means that a person or the employee cannot be sued for damages, or he cannot lose his job. In other words, he will not be deemed to be taking, committing misconduct or anything like that, breach of the agreement. Under the Act, an employer must deduct pay for work that is not being performed. So when an employer lockouts an employee, they can deduct pay for the hours that the employee was supposed to work and so forth. But other than that, there's no consequences that an individual employee can suffer as a result of protected industrial action. Protected industrial action can only be taken in certain steps. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but there's a ballot of the employees taken with the types of industrial action that's taken. And then if that's successful, there's certain minimum amounts of notice period that is needed to be given to the employer when a union intends to take industrial action. So that broadly is what industrial action is. I'll leave it to the other guys to say whether it's successful, how it is used, and when it can be used, and so forth.
I think it's probably also worth just saying for the members when you can take it. So it's only after the agreement has expired.
Correct. The other requirement is you can only take protected industrial action after the nominal expiry date of the agreement. The maximum term at an enterprise agreement can be is 4 years. And if it passes its normal expiry date, it will continue to apply until replaced or terminated. And it's during that period, we call it the bargaining period, post-nominal normal expiry date, that employees can take in protected industrial action.
So given we were just saying before that, you know, a deal can coalesce late, is it, I mean, I'm assuming PIA is something that's considered at a point where you think that basically there's irreconcilable differences? I mean, you just feel like you're not getting anywhere?
Or... Well, look, we're not going to go too much into strategy or anything like that. Yeah. But I think it's important to note that PIA is a tool that can be used by one of the parties, and in this case, it's the employees. Mm-hmm. Just the same as it is possible for an employer to apply to have an agreement terminated after the nominal expiry date. That is a tool that we've seen Qantas use. There are other tools which the Commission can assist with. There is bargaining orders. You can apply to the Commission to assist and facilitate interest-based bargaining over at the Commission. So there are a bunch of tools. This is just simply one of them.
Right.
I don't really want to go, and I don't think it's appropriate to go into too much detail about when is it appropriate and what is it. There are risks with any tools that you use, and they need to be carefully considered before even entertaining them, I think. But it is absolutely a tool that is open to employees to use.
I think it's worth saying, and it's not giving away any trade secrets, that in a negotiation, the party who's got the most options has the most power. So having the ability to take industrial action is just an option for employees. So it's just something that helps balance the power across the table. And I think, as we've discussed before, I think where things sit now, power generally lays in favour of the employer at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to take industrial action is an option for employees. And the mere fact that they have that option gives them power across the table. So you don't necessarily need to threaten to use it or actually take it. The mere fact that you can take it gives you options and gives you some negotiating power.
Okay. Now, has social media made the job of an EA negotiator easier or harder? And I ask this from the perspective of, does it make getting information to members easier, but does it also make it harder due to the level of misinformation that can be spread as well?
Yeah, I believe it has. Social media has great power, and overall, I think it is an extremely good thing from APA's perspective or from a negotiator's perspective. The reason why I like social media is because it allows members to directly, in real time, contact negotiators or other representatives from APA. It allows the passing on of information. They can ask questions. We give them information. Probably the best aspect of it is, though, is that we all know rumours amongst pilots can spread more than, you know, rumours in a primary schoolyard.
Yep.
The ability to ask those questions, hey, I've heard this, is that true? And you can nip it in the bud straight away, because these things can grow a life of its own. Social media is not without risks. We could do a whole podcast on what are the rules that apply to social media. Standards of conduct within Qantas actually apply to conduct that we engage in on social media. So it's very important. I like it. It's very time consuming though, and pretty resource intensive. I know my wife has continuously told me, put down the phone, you need to stop answering these questions. But the ability to inform the members in a far more up-to-date and real-time forum is I think, fantastic, and a difficult area to navigate for APA as an organisation, but on the whole, I think a good thing.
Yeah, I wish to add to what Mark said and just say that I think social media, we probably need to do another podcast on that alone, because it involves the EA. It can be a very emotive thing, and pilots think when they sit alone somewhere at home even, and they jump on social media and they get fired up about something that they've heard and they say something on social media, they don't think about the fact that the Qantas Code of Conduct might apply to that post, because they think they're at home off duty, and that's when they get into trouble. So I agree with Mark, it's a very effective tool, but I think we as APA need to probably think about how are we going to educate our members engaging with the enterprise agreement negotiations in a responsible way, understanding that it can have consequences before we enter into bargaining again.
Okay. Now, how can our members assist in the collective effort of an EA negotiation? What role can they play throughout this process?
I think it's a bit of what I said earlier. We've all got to be engaged with the process. When surveys are put out, answering them, giving full and forthright, taking the time when there's a free text response to, it takes 20 minutes to sit there and write a really thorough response to something because you've got a view. Take the time to do it. We read every single response. And in some of the large EA surveys, just sitting and reading the responses can take a day just to read all of them.
Yep.
We then categorise them and put them together, and you get that view of where the membership is at. Being engaged with the process is vital.
Yeah, it just seems to be engaged and informed.
Yes.
And I hate to say it, in a union, solidarity is still alive, isn't it? Like, it's something that if we've got all the members as a collective all rowing in the same direction, that is that a benefit to you as a negotiating team?
Absolutely. As agents of the membership, yeah, our power comes from the unity of the members. Absolutely. The one thing that I would add to what Jason was saying, educate yourself, and APA has a role to play with that, and through these podcasts, I think we're moving in the right direction. But probably the second thing, I think, is just be respectful of your colleagues. Everyone's going to have a different opinion, and as Philip identified, it's quite an emotive time. Everyone's going to have a different opinion about it. Be respectful to your colleagues, and please be respectful to your negotiators as well. We've had plenty of instances in the past where I think that's been lacking somewhat, but it's a very emotional time, And whoever's sitting in the chair doing the negotiations and their support team is spending a lot of hours away from their family doing this work.
Agree well, disagree well seems to be a pretty reasonable way to do it, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Lastly, is there anything any of you would like to add to this discussion?
The only point that I wanted to raise, I think, which will be useful for our members, is when we talk about the playing field, APA never deliberately delays negotiations. It is in our members' interest to get a deal done as efficiently as possible. Mm-hmm. So we get the right agreement. Of course, we're not going to agree to something that our members wouldn't vote for and doesn't satisfy their concerns. But we're not interested in delaying things. It's not in our members' interest inherently to delay things. So I've done two short-haul EAs and the most recent variation for short-haul. The first two EAs took over 2 years. The variation that we just did took less than 6 months. And there's a reason for that, and it's because it suited Qantas's interest. It was in Qantas's interest to get it done quickly. So I would just like people to think about that. And in against that backdrop that we have, we spoke about good faith bargaining provisions before, where it can lead itself to an employer just sitting there with their arms folded and saying, we're not agreeing to anything. We're going to let your pay rises fall, by the way, so we're going to let back pay build up until that applies enough pressure for you to vote yes. When it's in the company's interest to do it, Qantas can do it. They can allocate the resources to it. They can allocate the manpower to it, and they can get it done. I just think it's very interesting that we can spend 2 years and still not come up with an agreement, yet somehow within 6 months, which was a ridiculously short time frame, let's be honest, to do an entire variation, it can actually be done.
Well, hopefully there'll be no dragging of the feet next year.
Well, he's hoping. I wanted just to leave with one thought. The executive manager of industrial relations back in 2010 made a speech, which I'm sure some of our listeners will remember. In it, she said, you can't run a successful airline unless you get your industrial relations right. Now, given what's happening and some of the operational issues that we have right now, I think it's open to question, has Qantas got its industrial relations strategy right?
Thanks again to Philip, Jason, Chris and Mark for their time today and interesting insights on a complex yet vitally important topic to us all. That's it for today's chat. Don't forget to get in touch with the podcast with feedback and ideas via office@apa.org.au. And don't forget to put podcast in the subject line. We'll be back with another episode soon. In the meantime, fly safe and stick with it.